right, I think we've got Morris Mizalowski there now. Good afternoon to you, Morris.
And good afternoon to you, Jason.
How's things happening over there in the eastern states? Are you having great weather like we are here?
We certainly are. It's been some glorious days.
But you, like me, probably spent half your life indoors.
Well, yes, there is a lot of truth in that. Although there is a window I look out at occasionally.
Now, Morris, something I find absolutely fascinating is that after 204 years, it seems the Encyclopaedia Britannica may no longer be printed as a set of encyclopedias.
Yeah, absolutely. So Encyclopaedia Britannica made an announcement this week that this year would be the last year that they would print a hard copy of their encyclopaedia, as you said, after 244 years of doing it.
So, I mean, what happens? I mean, we're moving all this stuff into the digital world. What happens if we have one of these huge sunbursts and it erases all the digital data we've got and we have no encyclopedias to refer back to?
Now, wouldn't that be interesting? So the answer would partially be that we do have encyclopedias and there'll be hard copies around forever, we suppose. And hopefully someone's backed up the system and they can get some mice into a wheel and get it cranked up really fast.
You'd want to hope, wouldn't you?
You would want to hope.
Do we know, I mean, round about how much was it to buy a set of encyclopedias? I mean, I'm recalling that it was in the thousands.
It was. Well, I can tell you that this set, the last one that's going to be sold, will sell for $1,395. And in their heyday, they went somewhere between about $1,500 and about $2,000.
It'd be quite a good collector's item, wouldn't it?
I think it will be, although there were lots sold. Their peak year apparently was 1990, and they sold 120,000 sets worldwide. So it would take a while until it becomes a collector's item, I'd suggest.
I wonder how many sets of Microsoft Encarta were sold in the same year.
Yeah, it would be interesting to know, wouldn't it? But what's really interesting is to reflect back on Encyclopaedia Britannica and the World Book. Remember the good old World Book?
Oh, yes, yes.
I mean, they were really the two major sources of information. When you went to school anyway, I remember doing most of my projects and things out of both of them, and there was an expectation that what was written in them was as correct as any piece of information you could find on the planet.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of questions asked these days about the quality of the information we find on things like Wikipedia.
Absolutely. And it's a very different construction around Wikipedia, too, because it was constructed by people ongoing, so people that not necessarily have credentials in it, but that have something to say that they want put out there.
So you're suggesting that it could be a little bit biased in many instances?
Well, bias is really in the eye of the beholder, but absolutely, I think it must be, because it's curated again by individuals. There is a team that oversees it, and they're supposed to be quite zealous at their job, and last year got into some trouble because they pulled a number of articles because they thought they were too biased. But again, it's curated by individuals, so I guess it has to be in some ways. But the interesting phenomenon between the two is Britannica, as much as we loved it, was old by the time we read it.
Exactly right, yeah.
I remember waiting every year for the new book, and that, of course, brings me back to geek and nerddom, and I accept that. But waiting for the new book to come out every year, and that was supposed to be the most newest, wonderfulest thing that we could know about whatever topic was in it. But the reality is it was probably about 2 years old by that stage. But the world was a place that we really didn't matter that was 2 years old because it was still considered to be current. And nowadays, if it's anything over 2 minutes, sometimes we complain that it's old information.
Ain't that the truth, yeah. All right, let's talk about homeless hotspots. This sounds both like a very positive thing and a really terrible thing.
Well, I want to give your opinion on it. It kind of goes into this Encyclopaedia Britannica, how the world's changed. So this has happened over the last 2 weeks in Austin, Texas. There's this wonderful program that goes on called South by Southwest. Been going for about 16 years or so. It's, again, lots of geeks and nerds getting together, and the last 10 years or so has included a lot of technology and a lot of computer technology, and especially mobile technology. What one of the marketing firms this year decided to do was to go and to work with a homeless shelter, and what they did was to give out MiFis, which are really very, very, they're Wi-Fi devices, but used in public. So they gave these MiFi devices, little MiFi devices, to a range of homeless people and said to them that if somebody wants to use the MiFi, wants to use the network signal that you have, charge them whatever you want and keep all of the money. So what you had were homeless people that were walking around, had this MiFi, people would come up and ask to be connected to it, be given a password, and then they would pay whatever they thought was appropriate for the use of that internet connection.
It is quite clever, and it's great that it's putting money in the pockets of people who need it, but it still feels very much like exploitation.
It does, and this is the really interesting thing of how far we've come. Now, in many ways, it's not exploitation. In many ways, it is. Firstly, there was no advertising on any... I mean, homeless people, there was a rumour going around homeless people had to wear T-shirts. That wasn't true. So the only way the MyFi was found was because there was an app on your mobile device that told you were close by. Homeless people got to keep every cent that they made. There was no publicity of the individual person carrying it through. And the marketing company agreed to pay $50 a day minimum, regardless of how many people on top of that use the service.
Oh, well, that does change it a little bit.
It does. And the minimum wage in Texas is $7.25. Now, we're talking about a group of people that, for a reason at this time, aren't most probably able to get employment.
Mm.
So, again, I'm not on either side, but then they started to talk about the notion of it's not really that different because there's a newspaper that you can buy that is predominantly sold by homeless people.
That's true.
And they would pay half of the fee and obviously get to keep the other half. And there's always been projects around where homeless people are given work to do and paid for it. So I'm, again, not sure which way we go on this, but to me it's an evolution of our thinking that now, you know, this internet world that we've talked a lot about over this season, this online world, is now spreading into this and becoming a possible way of homeless or other people earning an income.
It just feels a little frustrating that they're carrying this technology to allow people to get onto the net, but they don't actually have the ability to get onto the net themselves.
Well, that's an interesting point, because this same marketing company in New York about 4 weeks ago did a really interesting experiment. They gave a group of homeless people prepaid cell phones and Twitter accounts, and they asked them to tweet all day about their activities. So to tell people, not necessarily where they were sleeping, but what it was like to sleep there, where they were getting food, what were their issues, their gains, their pluses for the day. And if you have a look around, it was called the New York Project. If you have a look at some really interesting insights, almost minute by minute, of these homeless people and how their lives unfold over a period of days.
Yeah, it's an interesting social experiment. Now, Morris, I spend an awful lot of time online, but it appears I'm not alone.
No, you're not alone. There must be somebody else out there too doing the same, apart from me. So there's an interesting set of stats that comes out every year, and this is a set of stats by ComScore. So this year's stats came out, and some interesting phenomena. One of them is something, again, you and I have talked about for a while, and that is the decline of email usage across the platform. So what ComScore does is it goes online, it runs these surveys across all kinds of categories, and asks people for their input of how they're using particular things. So what we have is the ages of 12 to 17-year-olds have declined in their email usage by 31%.
Oh, those pesky kids.
And between the ages of 18 to 24-year-olds have declined by 34%.
But, you know, Morris, it feels very much like you and I are sitting here in our deck chairs going, you pesky kids, get off my lawn. You know, because they're doing things a little bit differently to what we're used to.
Well, they are, but when you look at the stats moving forward, the 35 to 44-year-olds are down 1%. 55 to 64 years of age are down 7%.
Huh.
The only age range, and I can't explain this yet, I've sent away for some understanding, is the age range between 45 and 54 years of age have increased by 15%.
Wow.
So what I'm supposing is that late majority of those people that are just beginning to understand or just beginning to find purpose or use for email are still in there, still using that. Now, what's happening with these other age ranges is not that they've stopped talking online. In fact, they talk more than they ever did before. But they're using all kinds of other places to talk in. And that was one of the other stats they came up with. So, guess what number one site is?
Oh,
no surprise.
eBay.
No. The number one site for social networking.
Oh, social networking. Facebook.
Absolutely. Facebook outstrips everything. Now, the average person across the globe is spending, these are people who are online anyway, are spending 7 hours a month in Facebook. Almost a full work day in Facebook alone.
That is just nuts.
Isn't it just? Now, number two is Tumblr.
No way, really?
Yes.
I think most of our listeners wouldn't have even heard of Tumblr.
It's not a particularly Australian place, is it? So Tumblr's about 2.5 hours, and Tumblr's kind of a visual blog, so it lets you put together all kinds of pictures and words and do that kind of activity and share that amongst your community. Now, the number three one is a really interesting one from my viewpoint. It's something we only spoke about 2 weeks ago, and that's good old Pinterest.
Yes, this is one that I think is more sort of leaning towards the female demographic.
It has. It's certainly, I think the stats are somewhere up around 80% or plus, 80% plus of its demographics are female. But it's getting such traction, and already in a survey, because a year ago it didn't exist for this survey, it's come up as number three, and people are spending 1.3 hours in that search engine. And it's kind of the canary in the cage. It's kind of the conversation that's being had now around this change towards curated conversations online, which is simply a way of saying that people are now trying to put their own lives, their own Google search engines together, if that makes sense, and tell people what they're looking at and what they think are important, and then sharing it out. And we're seeing so many websites opening up over the last year or so that are around this curated notion.
The times are changing. Morris, I'm going to have to let you go because we've run out of time, but we'll speak to you again next week. It'll be our last show for the season, so we'll make it a big one.
Sad, but looking forward to it nevertheless.
Good on you, Morris. Morris Michalowski there, our business futurist. And if you want to check out Morris's website, businessfuturist.com.